So what we're going to be talking about is mobile learning and games, but also educational technology in general. And we've going to take a look at kind of a global context of what's happening out there. Dr. Ress has got some amazing slides and information to share with us. And Dr. Priya Nihalani is going to be talking about mobile learning and games as situated learning environments, as well as formative assessment tools. And David Conover is going to be telling us about a game design curriculum that he has been leading at Pflugerville ISD. So to give you just a little bit of an overview of the session, what we're going to do is I'll give just a very quick background, and then each of the panelists will speak for about 10 minutes, and then we'll have plenty of time for Q&A. So I've given a little introduction off of the panelists, but Dr. Paul Ress said it's an honor and a pleasure for him to be here. He was a co-chair of my dissertation, and he is the chair of the Learning Technology Center for the School of Education just right across the street over there. He also has been the chair of multiple UNESCO groups, and that's United Nations Education and Scientific Organization. So Dr. Ress has been around in this space for a very, very long time, so it's great to have him here with us. Dr. Priya Nihalani is the chief scientist for Gylo. That's our educational software company that we started based on the research that we were doing here at UT as well as at Harvard. So she's going to tell you quite a bit about that. She was also named a UT fellow for her research throughout graduate school. Finally, David Conover is a 2011 Adobe Impact Award winner. And he, as I mentioned, has been leading a very innovative program in game design. So we've got a great panel here today. And the reason why this is an interesting thing for us especially is what we've been working on for over a year now is to create what we call an educational technology ecosystem here in Austin. We're trying to kind of plant the seed of that over the last week and this week through South by Southwest EDU as well as South by Southwest. And really what we're trying to do is pull together K through 12, higher education, industry, as well as a Chamber of Commerce. And the goal of this is to create career pathways, to create job experience, and to prepare students for either college or a career after high school. So one of the ways that we try to do that is by pairing up these different entities, K through 12, and industry work together in terms of our company, Gylo, builds games that assess higher order thinking and problem solving, and David students get to actually work on those games and QA testing, other types of experiences, but they also get to put that experience on their resume. So again, our goal is to get students jobs. I don't want to take up too much time because these guys have great things to say. So without any further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Paul Ressa.
Thanks, Michael. We'll make this very informal, but much of what we're going to talk about is really sort of a convergence of a number of trends. And my colleagues here will be talking more about games and simulation and mobile learning. And I'll be talking a little bit more about things that I don't think have been recognized as the kind of powerful factors that they represent for really changing education. As we know, you know, technology systems change exponentially. Social systems change incrementally. Unfortunately, education systems seem to have the slowest level of incremental change. And so education systems are in this context of things just changing dynamically all around them. I mean, knowledge doubles every 18 months. The digital universe has grown 10 times over the past 5 years. As you can see here, the digital universe, which is kind of the sum body of information that resides on the web, is now approaching 2,000 exabytes. And if you don't know what an exabyte is, you know, it's over a million terabytes. And this trend is also evident in terms of access to the internet. As Michael mentioned, I do a lot of my work with UNESCO. We've been very concerned seeing, citizens have a right to access knowledge and information. And in the past 10 years, we've moved from over 300 million individuals that had access to the internet to now we're approaching almost 2 billion people that have access to the internet. And so, you know, that's pretty amazing. Most of that growth, as you might expect, is in Asia and predominantly in China and in India. Interestingly, we have more English speakers on the internet in China than we do in the U.S. But for UNESCO, one of the areas that we're really excited about is this chart that you see here. And that is the growth in terms of mobile subscriptions around the world. And as you can see here, the blue line indicates that we actually have more mobile phones than in developed countries than we have people. The green line, however, is what's really exciting because in the year 2000, less than 3% of the population in developing countries had access to a phone. And now, in 10 years, we have two-thirds of the population in developing countries with access to a device that provides connectivity. And, you know, we're particularly concerned about Africa. During the same interval now, we have over 735 million mobile subscribers in Africa. So now, as you would recognize, the handheld devices by themselves are not very powerful, but what's been very exciting is that developing countries have been very creative about using this device for educational purposes, actually much more so than developed countries. And they are going to the cloud, and we're seeing the cloud coming into our educational system, school districts here in the Austin area and around the country are using Google Apps, for example. And the University of Texas, we're working with Google right now to make that pervasive through the university. So these are very significant trends. But what I want to talk more about is really the exciting developments in touch, gesture, and motion. And with the addition of these, we're starting to move towards to more of the full sensorium for learning. And a lot of that just started with the smartphone. You know, touch screens have been around for a long time. I mean, you've been using it with the ATMs. But when we had the iPhone, people started to recognize the potential and the power of touch capabilities. And this has really grown significantly with the iPad. We have now over 1,000 districts in the country that have one-to-one iPad initiatives. And what makes it so powerful is the way that you can interact with this. The tablet tablet PCs have outsold laptops within the last 6 months, and it's getting to be a very pervasive device for learning because it has a touch capability, but it's also something you can hold in one hand. So we're seeing touch on single devices like that, but I think what we're also very interested in is looking at the multi-touch capabilities. And this also offers opportunities to explore phenomena in a way that just hasn't been possible. This is looking at the human body. With touch, you can go from the skin level through the organs, look at the whole cardiovascular system, Here you can get into the skeletal system, and looking at all of this in ways that just were not possible with the previous ways of interacting with technology. And what we're very excited about is we've had interactive whiteboards. I mean, interactive whiteboards are pervasive in classrooms all over the country, and what made that so exciting over the projectors was the touch capability. But now we're seeing the multi-touch. Here you have examples of the smart table, this also at the bottom is the Promethean active table. And it enables collaboration, exploration in ways that just have not been possible in the past. So we're seeing very significant changes taking place and looking at the learning environment with the touch capabilities. What I'd like to submit is that we are just at the early stages of recognizing the potential of gesture for learning. And, here's an example of...
put together astronomy, information, and planetary data from all across the universe. And when we saw Kinect, we knew that we had to bring the universe to your fingertips with this great tool. Right now, we're looking at the Earth and low Earth orbit satellites, and the green ones are geosynchronous satellites. And we can come out here and zoom out away from Earth and start looking at the whole solar system here, basically move around and see all the planets. Now let's go ahead and select another planet that we'll go to. We'll scroll over here to Saturn, and we'll go ahead and fly into Saturn. And as we're coming into Saturn, you'll see something that looks like a ball of yarn that a cat's been playing too much with. And this is asteroids that have been captured to be new moons of Saturn. But as we zoom into Saturn even more, we can see the ring system here. And then you can see all the other moons that swarm with Saturn's rings. But the universe is much larger than our solar system. As our solar system moves off into just a single pixel, the rest of the stars that are around us are actually going to start moving from the constellation positions that they were familiar with.
So you might want to go ahead and look at the world telescope by Microsoft. But this is something that's appearing in classrooms. And so a student can actually have a whole sense of Earth's size, its position, its relationships. They can actually go out, and you can do this yourself, is go out into space. You can select a particular galaxy. You can enter that galaxy. And the gesture-based computing, represents another very powerful tool to enable exploration and learning by students. But, there's an aspect about gestures that we've tended to ignore, and that is how gestures affect us and affect our behavior. I'll just give you this one brief example. Cuddy at Harvard University did this study and had students take a pose. What you see on the left, they took these are two poses. They took each of these poses for 1 minute. And these poses are power poses. And it's not just humans. That whole kind of openness represents power in other species as well. And you see the opposite, which is the low power on the right, which is more of a closed-in type of gestural response. And what they found, even doing these poses for just 5 minutes resulted in significant neuroendocrine changes that in the power poses, they had an increase in testosterone, a lowering of cortisol. They also found changes in behavior, more willingness to take risks. If you were in a power pose and you found absolutely the converse of that, you know, in the low power positioning. And so, you know, we actually, one of our colleagues at NYU is looking at students interacting with math that have students have high math anxiety, where they're interacting with more open poses and finding some very interesting things that are happening in terms of feeling more powerful, more secure in doing math. One of my doctoral students, I'll show you this, is engaging gesture and motion, and mixing it with video games, and actually taking the video game outside in a mixed reality context. And so, what you see here is her research setup. The glasses have the video game is in one eye, and they're actually you know, seeing their environment with the right eye. But the video game results in them interacting with the objects in their environment and also in collaborating and doing things with other students. So it's taking the video game and actually moving it beyond just sitting at a chair with a video game, or even, you know, using Kinect to do some movement in the room. So why is all this important? I think it's significant because it's taking us back to the recognition that cognition is embodied. We've tended to be drifting away from that for a number of years. If you go to a typical high school, you'd think we would be in a Cartesian mode. I mean, the students are all sitting down, and we're just saying, you know, in a sense, the mind is separated from the body. And with touch, gesture, motion, and the kinds of developments you're going to hear about, I think we're starting to move towards multimodal learning. And that means it not only provides us with multiple means of representation, but different ways of acting and expressing ourselves and multiple ways of engaging. Now, one of the issues that does raise, however, is that we now have the potential to capture every action of a student in interacting with a computer. This, by the way, also reaffirms the intuitiveness of touch. This is a 2-year-old child that's doing significant learning activities very quickly without any kind of training. But just imagine this: if students working in a LMS system for an hour, you have 40 actions. Even if you had just 40 actions a day for a student in a high school with 1,000 students, and you multiply that times 180 days, and then you look at the entire size of that, you're talking about millions of data bits. And so we're having to, for the first time in education, really understand that we have to deal with massive educational data sets. And the problem with such massive data sets, it's very difficult for us using traditional modes of representation to really understand the patterns and the relations and trends that are embedded in that data. And so, you know, we're increasingly moving towards looking at visualization tools to help us do that. I'll give you one just example of that. One of my colleagues is working with virtual manipulatives, has students working with virtual manipulatives on an interactive whiteboard and captures every action of those students. And with this huge data set, it was difficult to try to comprehend what was the learning progression that was taking place here. This is an example of a very different kind of representation that really enabled her to see the patterns that were taking place. So all of this is leading to something that business has been doing for a number of years, and that is analytics. Taking a lot of the business analytic tools now and applying them to education so we can start taking the data, doing the analytics as well as the visualization. And that's one of the things that we're very much interested in the Learning Technology Center that I direct across the street. And if any of you are in Austin, we can later give you a tour. But our focus is on analytics and visualization and creating dashboards and displays that will really help the students, that will help the teachers and the administrators. So I all of these things are coupled together, and then you'll hear more about the emerging power of games and simulations to enhance learning as well. I'll turn it over to my colleague.
Thank you, Dr. Resta. How do I go to the next PowerPoint? I feel like I shouldn't be talking into this mic. This room is small enough. So thank you, Dr. Resta. I am Dr. Priya Nihalani, as Michael introduced me. I'm our chief scientist of the company that we run. It's an educational software company that we started a few years ago. And so Dr. Ressa talked about, kind of this global view of what's going on with education today and what's available. If I stand here, can you hear me okay? All right. And so what I want to focus on is specifically games. So we have this top-level view, and I want to sort of try and get in there a little bit. So here's where we are today with students who are graduating from schools here in the U.S. On math, we're ranked in the 25th percentile compared to the rest of the world, and in science, 17. So just to give you an idea of what this is showing, the dark red is where we are. The gray is the mean for the whole entire world, so we're below that. And then I just randomly picked Finland because I know that for these sorts of things, everyone always references, China or Korea, so I wanted to choose another place. That's how far below the average and some of the other countries that we are. It's kind of sad, actually, when you think about it. So part of the reason for this is that where we have gone with technology, the things that we're being taught in schools today, that information is available now. Technology is cheap. You heard from Dr. Resta the availability of mobile tools and online learning, all of that. It's cheaper and cheaper. We can educate basically anyone. So what happens within schools today? We're in a system right now where the people who are privileged are the ones who just know a lot of facts. What is not happening is privileging people or recognizing those people who can actually take those facts and solve problems. And so this is one of the reasons that games and related technologies is so interesting, because we can what we can do with games and the related technologies is we can put students in a situation where all a game is problem solving. That's all you're doing. You are going through a set of problems and just looking to solve them, right? So a game essentially is an assessment. That's all it is, where you are trying to solve a problem, you're being assessed, and if you can't do it, then you lose and you have to start over. You're being assessed over and over and over. And then in a game, you get to the boss level, the big test, and you move on from there. Sorry about this. I'm trying to kind of take like a different perspective than I know you guys have probably heard before. So this is taking a lot of different pieces and putting it together. So the thing about games is that you're being assessed. That's all it is. And it's fun, right? And within school, that element of assessment, that's the most dreaded part. But in a game, it's fun because it's handled differently. You're not put in a situation where you're told, all right, go learn the stuff, and a week you come back and then you take a test over it. In a game, you're constantly getting information and you're constantly applying it. And that knowledge curve within a game, you know where you are at all times because you get feedback. You're being told all this. So where we need to go is a place where the students that are leaving us today, leaving our schools, they're developing this idea of creativity and innovativeness and taking the tools that are at their disposal to create solutions to problems in a way that isn't just like a standard way of doing it, but it's creative, it's innovative. So this, I think that when we get to that place, we won't see something as sad as this right here. Now that idea within a game where, you know, you're given information, you apply it, you know exactly what's going on, you understand the context, and you don't have to think about, well, when am I going to use this information? And how many of you guys here are educators? Okay. Administrators? Okay. Students? All right, so students. I'm sure you guys think pretty often, when am I going to use this, right? And that's a pretty normal way to think. And within the sciences, we know that, you know, you only learn by doing. And that's not a new idea by any means. Within educational psychology, there's a learning theory behind that. It's called situated learning, and I don't want to spend too much time on this, but here are the main points. And this theory sets the stage for developing learning environments where you are learning by doing. You know, you think about medical school. It's great that they have all these simulations where you actually work on human bodies and you see the effect you have. That is a situated learning environment. And within games and simulations, we can create those easily. This is just a couple of screenshots from some examples that are being used today. Jasper Woodbury is one of them. And the next one... I think is that EcoMove?
It's River City and EcoMove.
Okay. River City and EcoMove. There's research being done right now at universities all around the country on developing these sorts of learning environments that are situated where you're learning about – at Harvard, Michael actually worked on this. Students are – they're working on a game where students are taught science skills by going into an environment, collecting data, knowing which data to collect. And then I actually worked on, for my dissertation, I worked on a game by Cisco, and it was to teach networking skills. And rather than just, you know, practice networking skills on a computer where you're learning how to put networks together and the insides of a computer, they take those that information that students have to learn, and what they do is they assign them an avatar, and you move throughout this game as an entrepreneur where you are running a networking company, and your job is to go to these different venues and set up different types of networks. And you can, on the computer itself, open up computers that you're working with and see what the insides look like. And that's more interesting, I think, than looking at a textbook. So there's this issue we have right now with relevancy. And I want to tell you a little bit about one of my first experiences playing video games when I realized that, okay, I'm a learning scientist. I want to learn more about this sort of medium. Let's do some research. And so I got Baldur's Gate. I don't know if you've played it, but the first thing I did when I got the box and opened it, like any good researcher, is I took out the manual and I started reading through it, and I couldn't understand anything in it. I have a PhD. I'm pretty smart, I think, and I couldn't understand anything in this manual. I couldn't understand the vocabulary, the cross specifications, all of this. Like, it made no sense to me, and so I thought, okay, I can't actually play this game. But I decided to just go ahead and try, which is what any kid would do, is just, you know, start playing and not bother going to the manual. I'm pretty sure most kids don't know that games come with manuals. And so I played for a couple hours, and I didn't play well. But then when I went back and looked at the manual, everything made sense. Everything made sense. And so what I ended up doing is using that manual just kind of as a reference tool, because I had played the game. So all the definitions that were in there, all that information, I understood it because I could now relate it to something. And there's no reason why, you know, a chemistry book can't be the same. You know, you've got a game manual. It's pretty, like, the language in it is pretty specific to that game. It's a different language than you're accustomed to. Chemistry is kind of the same thing, or biology, any science, where you've got these books that are so language-specific, but unless you can relate it to something, unless you've interacted with that information, it's kind of just sitting there. And so what I believe is that, you know, textbooks should be reference manuals where you interact with information in a situation, and when you have a specific question, you know where to find it, and so you proactively go into a textbook looking for that information. So what I want to do is show you an example, a product that Michael's and my company is developing, and it's for introductory statistics. It's a class that almost everyone has to take. It's a class that is difficult to kind of handle because you don't have context. Right? So this is just some background on what's going on with math today. Everything's back to math, and it's the reason why students aren't doing well in it. It's the reason why we've lost ground in these other disciplines. So the game that I'm going to demo for you guys, I want to show you this idea of, you know, moving in a situation and kind of having a specific question, going to a reference, going back and sorry to ruin the end for you, but have success. what this is some of our products. This first one is our e-textbook, and that's some of the information that's been modified and dropped into this game. The second is a screenshot of our game. It's called Row Planet. And the third is all of that on a laptop. These programs are they're cross-platform. And so let me just set the scene a little bit for this demo I'm going to show you. It's for introductory statistics, and the issue with stats is, you know, it's inferential reasoning, and so you have to use data to kind of decide what your next move is, and you also have to go through data to figure out what's useful and what's not and make conjectures like that. It's like, it's basically, it's the scientific method. It's hypothesis testing. I'm running out of time, so I will quickly go to this. So this is actually a tower defense game where, is it playing? There we go. This is a tower defense game. Essentially, you are the captain of a planet, and you're defending it from aliens. And you have access to different types of defenses. And so you place them, you get data back about how they operated, and then you're put into a new situation where you can modify your defenses based on what you know is coming at you, what you have to defend, how they previously acted. And this is the planning mode. And here they are coming at you. This is just a demo. It's we're about to hit beta for this. But you can see data is collecting up there in the corner. And so you kind of made a hypothesis about what would work to defend your defend what you're trying to defend. And now you're seeing it act out. And you lost. But then you get some more information back, and here is right there is where you have access to a reference manual. You're given data back about how your tower's operated, and if you have all that information, you might not remember right then, right there, like what that information is, how to use those numbers. And so before you go back in, you can look it up and see if you can get some help. So this game was designed by us. We're educational psychologists, and we work with game designers, and we give them some constraints to work around. So we want tools to be fun, and you know, we want students to be engaged with learning. And this is much more engaging than a textbook as we traditionally know it. We know that. So one of the other things that this has is information for the teacher based on how the student is doing. This is a teacher dashboard. It's part of a learner's profile. So I'm going to end with this quote. You know, school isn't really seen as very cool right now. It's not what students want to do with their time. And if you think about what you do in school, you can understand why that is. You're taking in this information, and you're only given kind of lame examples in which you apply it. You know, we all know those books where it's when you're learning algebra or geometry, you have to play as an architecture, someone who's doing architecture and building a building. It doesn't even make any sense for me to explain it out. But if school was of the environment where you were actually learning this information and applying it in relevant situations, I'm pretty certain it wouldn't be seen as quite so lame. So that's kind of where I feel that we need to be, where we would like to go, and that is for all of us here, that's what we're trying to work towards. So.
Thank you, Priya. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is David Conover, and I teach at Pflugerville High School, Pflugerville School District. I teach at Conley High School. And let's see. So let me tell you about what we did last summer or so. One of the things that I'm proud of is that one of our students entered the National Scholastic Award for Game Design, and they were awarded a silver prize, and as a result, thanks to our superintendent, we were able to go off to Carnegie Center and receive an award for our students' adventure into game design. So right off the bat, these students are getting recognition for their understanding of how to integrate game design into learning about STEM, which is science, technology, engineering, and math. So after that, we decided to create a summer program, and it was a two-week camp, and it was made possible from some support from AMD. And the focus on this camp was to design games that teach about STEM. And luckily we had Dr. Watkins, who works here at the University of Texas. He was a part of the MacArthur Foundation, and he was there to interview and document the process. So what I want to do is show you this clip whereby he's making some comments as to the process and the outcomes of the students.
The program was really kind of multifaceted, helping kids learn digital media skills, helping kids sort of understand the value of entrepreneurship, working together in a collaborative setting. They're really trying to create a space where they can develop those kinds of 21st century kinds of literacies and competencies that we hear so much about in terms of what kinds of skills and toolkits these kids will need to thrive in the future. These are kids who come from a school that really is not a very affluent school. It's kids who are working families and are really just striving and trying to work hard and just maintain every day. And to see them kind of show up every day, motivated to learn, engaged in learning, which is really wonderful to see. And I think it sends us all a really sort of clear signal and clear message that these kinds of learning spaces really are the kinds of spaces that we should be creating for more and more of our students.
What I would take is that you have to work with a group, and so you'll have to have someone else to rely on, and in turn, that will rely on you. So there's some accountability for your work. And it's not just something that you would consider a bit arbitrary, because you would be working for a common goal with people around you.
What I would take from this whole experience would be the more hands-on approach to it, since in most classes, the teacher can teach you it, but you won't actually do it, because everyone wants to be lazy.
I think it's meeting the people. Personally, it's great to learn how to produce a game, it's great to do the art, and it's wonderful to talk to your supervisor, but I think it's the people that you need that makes it really big. Because if we were all mindless and we all knew what we were doing, we would come out with a great game, but we wouldn't have had as much fun as we did without getting to know one another. I know we had a lot of conflicts team-wise, but to see us actually finally go, you know what, I want to collaborate with you instead of fight you, it was just great. It's the communications there that I just enjoyed it. It was so much fun to just meet the people.
The thing about these students is how peer-driven this was. I would go and visit them, and the teacher literally, seldom if ever, was kind of involved in this sort of group and team and collaboration. It really was kind of peer-driven. Students taught each other. And you really did see that grit, right, where students figured something out that they didn't know. Many of these students had never used the game creation platform, GameStop. And by the end of 2 or 3 weeks, they had figured it out and were really creating kind of credible games. So what I learned from this is just, these types of informal kind of formal learning environments where you bring in game design, let kids pursue their own interests, their own passions, let them work together, but they really can create some pretty amazing things. And the motivation, engagement, and immersion level literally was just off the charts. I think these students are the future. These students here represent the demographics and the populations that are transforming this country, how we will look in the next 15, 20, 25 years. What they learn today will impact who we are tomorrow.
So let me set this up. We had our students take on the role of creating their own companies, and they were going to be paid to create their own games. So These students created their own mission statements, their own vision statements, their own value system. So they kind of were in charge of setting up their own company. So now we're kind of integrating entrepreneurism into the game design process. So they would take on different topics, such as energy conservation, water conservation, land conservation, and build games around those topics. And ultimately, they were part of a contest, and one of the winners was able to go on and further develop their game, which will be soon released on an Apple iPhone or a tablet or the Android device. So once again, these students are collaborating. They're working on project-based learning. They're learning by doing. And it's great to see that the outcomes were really kind of recognized from a higher education point of view. Once again, our end game here is for our students to graduate from our four-year career track program, which we're creating, and we want to make sure that they go on to higher ed or get a job in the industry here. So let me just briefly tell you that we're continuing to explore how video games increase engagement and helps students learn about STEAM. I see on a daily basis these kind of activities, such as I watch students manage their choices and consequences as they design their games. These students are also allowed for failure, which is a different kind of approach in some of the other classes, because we really don't want to encourage failure, but yet in the game design process, due to its iterative nature, the students design, they get feedback from their peers or from people from the specialists, from the interest specialists from the game design industry. They come in and kind of review the students' progress along the way. They give them feedback. What they are failing in, they have an opportunity to address and to fix. So I see learning take place on a daily basis, and I see transformation taking place on a daily basis through the process of making games. I see critical thinking taking place. There's problem solving. Again, I mentioned something about the iterative design process, and there's collaboration on a daily basis. You see students getting up out of their chairs and walking across the room to work with other students. So it's not in that kind of teachers in front of the class and the students are sitting in their seats. They're up and about, much like an ad agency where the creative process is this kind of going through this natural flow, and the students make managed decisions as to how the game is going to be designed. One student will take on the role of being a project manager. Another student will take on the role of being an illustrator. Another student will take on the role of being a storyboard. So I see examples of students go from taking an idea and illustrating it out and storyboarding it, yet they never had a chance or thought of themselves as being an illustrator. So I have a whole classroom full of undiscovered genius. And when they take on the role, because they're very motivated and passionate about game design, they uncover hidden talents. And as a result, their engagement is increased, their motivation is increased, and they want to continue to further explore that topic, whether it's related to science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. My classroom really recognizes and values the creative skills that are taking place, and we really need to emphasize bringing those creative skills to the forefront. So we're making a better world for our diverse students through game design. We're preparing them for jobs in the game design industry here in Austin, and also preparing them to take on higher education and explore some of the game programs that are being in development here at UT, St. Edward's, ACC. So we want to make sure that these students are, what we're doing is kind of creating a feeder tube to these universities and to the game industry. I'm using some of the components and some of the tools from Adobe. We're using Photoshop and others for these students to cut their teeth on exploring how digital media and game design interact. Microsoft recently approached us, and they would like to have our students design video games for the Xbox. Another example of what our students are doing is we've got about 10, 15 students in one class that's going to be interacting with about 10, 15 students in Cambodia. So as a result, we're going to be uploading and downloading games that will show off our different cultures as well as our languages. So imagine students designing games that will allow for English as a second language to be learned. Students are using... we're also working with the geoscience senior research faculty here at the University of Texas. These students are working on games and using some software that will allow for scientific visualization for such topics as the surface of Mars, how global warming takes place, how climate change takes place. So these students are already exploring some of the attributes of scientific visualization. Once again, we're using Minecraft as one tool to allow for this kind of software to take place. In addition to other softwares as well, we're using GameSalad, GameStar Mechanic, we're using Kodu, we're using Scratch. The point is we want to get these students to learn about programming as well as to further engage them in exploring the STEM, which is the areas that we recognize that we need to improve on. So moving forward, what we're doing is we're in the planning stages of creating a certification program for these students so that we will ensure that they will be employable when they graduate from our high school, so that if they want to take on the role of being QA for a game design company, they'll be certified to be able to do so. We want to make sure that they're certified in programming. So this is something that's in the works, but yet we see a great demand for this. We're also further developing our ecosystem with our district, the local entrepreneurs, the gaming companies, the small businesses, and with the government as well. So we're trying to further develop this ecosystem that's a part of our PISD environment. We're also going to continue to create social and educational value for these students. It's amazing to see how these students run to my classroom at 7:30 in the morning. They don't want to leave until 7:30 at night because they see the value of getting a job, but they also are learning about these skills, but they're doing it in a they're understanding these skills in a very discreet way because it's all about through gameplay and game design. So there's learning that's taking place, but it's done through serious play. And we're also promoting financial and social equity because, once again, these students might not have all the chances that the average student will get. So it's really important to our district to ensure that these students have an access to be able to go on to get a job in the industry as well as to go on to higher ed. I'm looking forward to answering any of your questions when we get to our QA session. Ready. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we have a few minutes for questions, and if you would, please step up to the mic, and that way we can get recorded on the podcast, please. And just so you know, we have the contact information for all the panelists today, as well as my information and our Facebook and Twitter information, too. Please.
Hi, my name is Corey Schmidt. I'm with Drexel University, the Director of Learning Technologies there. And I guess my question is for Dr. Resta. I guess my problem at the university is getting faculty buy-in. I've seen a number of presentations here, external companies developing games and whatnot. I have a team to create it, but I need faculty buy-in and subject matter expertise. So, and I have dean-level buy-in, university buy-in, too. So I don't know if you have any comments about that.
Well, that is the big challenge in universities, getting faculty buy-in, and you know, one of the ways that you can do this is to start with the faculty that are the early adopters. I'll give you an example that's not quite maybe what we're talking about, but I think it manifests kind of a strategy that does work. And that is, we're the first public university that had a laptop requirement for our teacher education program. And actually, how we started that was we started with loaner Computers. So we use a cohort model. So every student in a cohort, all the faculty members, all had the same platform. They all had the same software tools, and so what happened? Actually, if I'm going to really confess, it was kind of not the brightest thing on my part, because my view, I'm a professor of instructional technology. My model was we'd give every cohort a one-semester experience in a immersive computing environment. So we started with one cohort. Well, guess what happened at the end of that semester? The faculty came into my office and says, you can't take these computers away. We've totally changed the way we're teaching. We have a whole community here working online. So I went back to the dean. I said, well, can we get another set of computers for another cohort? And maybe I'll go ahead and test my model. Well, you know, still not too bright, right? And exactly the same thing happened with the second cohort. But the powerful thing that happened was now we had two cadres of faculty that had totally transformed the teaching learning paradigm that they were doing. And so they became advocates with the other faculty. You know, faculty won't listen to you or me. They only listen to each other. So if you have faculty that can, you know, attest to the fact that this really is transformative, that's how we got the faculty in this whole department. And we had some that were close to retirement saying, I'm willing to take a chance. I'm going to take this risk, knowing that all students are going to be coming into my class with their laptops and expecting me to do something significant with it. The other critical variable is providing support systems for the faculty. So one of the things we did is we created, we call it the Idea Studio, but it's a faculty development, faculty support unit, and any faculty member can go in there and they know that there are people there that will support them with whatever they want to do. So it's it doesn't work top down. It has to be a combination of both, you know, bottom up and top down. But, you know, it's now just part of our environment. You know, and it's in, technology is invisible because it's just been so embedded in that. So that's one strategy that seems to work.
Do we have time for another question? Great. Any other questions?
I know this is maybe not what this is about, but how what are your ideas about cracking the code on where the money comes from for game development? I work for a company. We've been at it for 15 years, and in that time, we've probably spent over 15 years bringing maybe a couple million bucks over from K through 12 education, despite trying very hard. I mean, last year we went out and invested in some new games and a new platform and yada yada, nothing came back. Pentagon calls, hey, here's $1 million, go make a game. Guess what we're doing this year? You know, time and time again, K through 12 education, so depressingly vacuous of how we make revenue, and everyone's incentivized to have pupils that regurgitate facts, not solve problems.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So.
So within your company, what is it made up of? Is it game designers, people in technology? Are there any people from the field of education?
Mostly game designers. Not many pure educators.
Okay, that's where the issue is. So our company is it's the marriage between people who know technology, people who know education, and a couple of people in between. And that, if that component isn't there, if you don't have somebody on your team who knows education, who can take whatever product you're creating when you get to a proof of concept and take it out and test it and vet it and do modifications with your target audience and, you know, test for true learning effectiveness, like empirical evidence of knowledge growth, that might be where the issue is, at least from my perspective.
I'll speak a little bit more to what Priya's talking about, because she has to do the delicate dance between the game designers and the education components of the game, and it definitely is kind of a ballet. It's a challenging thing to build a good game that also provides that situated learning environment and is also a formative assessment. It gets pretty complex. But to go to your question about funding, I think one of the things that we've been very fortunate to have is through going through graduate school and all these different types of degrees and networking for years in the academic world, we've been able to meet guys at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and all these different organizations. So there's definitely funding out there from a lot of different sources. There's the granting organizations like Bill and Melinda Gates. They're strongly looking at this type of work, but also the more kind of like the corporate side. Angel investors and VC. There was a panel yesterday here in Classroom 2020 in the same room that was talking all about the same thing as venture capitalists looking to get into this space. There's never been more money being invested in educational technology than ever before. So there's money out there for it. It's still obviously very competitive. There's more startups also at the same time than ever before. So I think, we kind of go about it both ways. There's the grants and the nonprofit side. Of course, writing a small business innovation research grant is very, very tough. So if you can have a relationship with someone at Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation or those types of organizations, it helps out a little bit more. So the money's out there, but you do have to be compelling just like any other business. Any other questions? Nope.
Any questions from teachers?
Excellent. Okay. Well, I want to say thank you to all the panelists. You guys did a great job. And this has been, as I mentioned at the beginning of the session, I think this is our sixth presentation over the last week or so. So it's been a good one. And welcome to Austin. If it's your first time here, have a good trip home. Hope you guys can stay for South by Southwest music for the rest of the week, because it'll definitely be a good time. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you, guys.